do an insolvency event, administration and so on, liquidation, and the full effect files that we can step in and take over any ongoing client matters to mitigate clients' interest. So that's important to us. So I wanted to mention that to you and also link back to our reporting guidance there. So that says at a high level what the reporting obligations are and how we might approach those reports. So I think that's all I was going to say. I think the next slide, Emma, yeah, it's questions and issues. So very happy to take any questions on anything that I've said or anything that you feel it would be useful for me to cover. I know quite a lot about a lot of this, but I certainly don't know everything. So I'm hoping that I've got a member of my team on the call. And if Georgia isn't on the call, if you could take a note, that would be really helpful as well of anything that we want then to go away and research or look at, and we will try and bring them back to this group or have an FAQ or something to help deal with any concerns.
If anyone has any questions, please feel free to unmute yourself and have your say.
I've got one about trainee solicitors on furlough. Is it anticipated that the time on furlough will effectively pause the period of recognised training, or might there be circumstances where time on furlough could count towards the period of recognised training? For example, training or other non-income generated activities that still comply with furlough.
So we do have a couple of Q&As on the education and training section, as we have been asked that before. So I'll answer it perhaps in a slightly circular way. And I'll start off because this may be of interest to you. So trainees who are currently not furloughed but are home working, our rules, our Q&A makes it clear that that's fine. They can be, as long as they're appropriately supervised, in however you would feel best to do that, then that will continue. That's fine. That there's no time limit to that, so they can continue to work supervised, and that will obviously count to their period of recognised training. If a trainee is furloughed, then what we're saying is it really depends on how long the furlough is, and I don't think we've really thought about, and I'll come back to you on doing non-legal work or doing work that might count, because my understanding was that if you're furloughed you can't work. So if you're furloughed and therefore not doing legal work that counts, what we're saying is ultimately it's up to the training principal to assess, bearing in mind how long the period of furlough is and you know your trainee skills and competence, whether you think they meet our practice, our professional, our practice skills requirements. So can you say they are competent, they have the skills required to be admitted? If you feel they have and you don't need to extend the period of their recognised training, then that's your judgment call. If you think that perhaps they're furloughed for 3 months and it would impact upon their qualifications, they won't actually have the skills necessary, then it would be a question of having the discussion with your trainee and extending the period of recognised training, in which case we would ask you to tell us of that case so we can amend our records. So that's what we've said in our Q&As, but I don't think we picked up your point, which is might they be doing other work which might count. I suppose my initial reaction was, how would you know what they were doing and how would that be supervised so that you were sure it was of sufficient quality to be able to put into the mix?
Okay, I was thinking around training and things like that. You're allowed to do training whilst on furlough. That's one example of something you could do that we might actually provide to be able to supervise.
That's helpful, and I will take a note of that, because I don't think anyone had asked that question before. But if your trainees were doing legal work, but they were, you know, enhancing their skills and knowledge by doing some self-learning or by researching or doing other issues, then I would have thought, when you're looking at the skills and competence as the training principal, you would be taking that into account when reaching that judgment call about their skills and competence?
Yes, I do. For example, there are a couple of trainees on this call who are on furlough, so it's this is the sort of thing, isn't it?
Oh, well, training,
learning about SRA rules.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a good point, and we'll take that away. And as I say, it's the first time it's been asked, but I'll see if we can tweak or perhaps expand on our Q&A perhaps to cover that point. Thanks, Clive.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Yeah, if I could ask a question. The Welsh government recently issued potential funding for legal firms, and the eligibility criteria require them to demonstrate that they've suffered either a 60% reduction in turnover if they're an SME, or 40% reduction in turnover if they're a micro business. If a firm has submitted such an application to the Welsh Government, declaring that they've had such a reduction, would they necessarily therefore have to declare themselves as financially unstable as far as the SRA are concerned?
My instinct is, first time I've heard of that, and well done the Welsh Government, but instinct is no, they wouldn't have to declare it to us, because one of the things I mentioned to Steve is my husband is a partner in a firm in Coventry, and one of the issues obviously is funding, that you need to make sure that you can manage your cash flow and you can pay the bills that you have to pay and pay staff. So, you know, bank borrowings, partners' contributions, government loans. I think that's a different issue to me about serious financial instability or insolvency. You know, if you have sources of funds where you're looking for funding to help continue your businesses during this period, I think that's probably perfectly right and proper. And I don't think that of itself would be something that we would need to know about. I think it's a different issue to a financial instability where you're very much concerned about, you know, the business viability of your firms.
Thank you.
If anyone has a question they don't wish to ask it, I can always take it in the chat function for you. And certainly if there are things that you think of after the event, both Steve and I are very happy to collate those and pass them on to Carol and the team. Anybody else?
Emma, I had a question. It's Tom Bedford. Sorry, I've not got my video on. I act for solicitors who are subject to SRA investigation and disciplinary action. It's part COVID related and part not. It takes a really long time for those investigations to reach a conclusion. And also then the disciplinary action for decisions to be taken as to whether, for example, the individual is going to be referred on to the SDT. Obviously the SRA is investing heavily in its website and other things. Is the SRA investing in how to speed up that process? And also is COVID going to impact timescales as well? Because obviously it's a really worrying time for the people I act for.
Yes. In answer to the first part about timeliness of investigations, yes, absolutely. You know, at the moment we're continuing on business as usual in terms of our investigation function. Everyone is homeworking and are set up to homework and are progressing matters. But understanding, sort of, I'm answering the second part of your question now. Understanding that some people will find it difficult to access the information to respond to issues or to perhaps also have the bandwidth, particularly for smaller firms, to deal with issues. And at the moment, there's a balance between progressing matters as promptly as we can, because it's probably better for the individual to get it dealt with and resolved, but also understanding that there are practical difficulties and balancing those two. And they're very much alert to this, and granting extensions, potentially putting things on hold if things can't be dealt with. But also, you know, bearing in mind our sort of more public interest function of if there is a serious issue, of trying to progress it as best we can. They're very much aware of the issue about the impacts of coronavirus on those they're investigating and trying to be proportionate and pragmatic and sympathetic to those issues. So yes, that's very much on the horizon. Going back to the first part about general timeliness, again, yes, there is obviously, you know, it is a clear desire that when we do investigate matters, to do so as promptly as we can, because, as you say, it's very stressful for the individual under investigation to have something hanging over their head. We may well have a complainant or some other individual which wants the matter to come to conclusion. So they're obviously always trying to deal with things as promptly as we can. Sometimes there are external factors, particularly if it's external parties involved, in terms of that. So I'm not in those units, and I know that we have KPIs and things that we're driving to make sure that we deal with things as quickly as possible, and that's always been a feature of what we do. Sometimes things do take longer than I think we might like, so I do accept that the ongoing need to try and drive things forward as quickly as possible, and on the coronavirus issue particularly, then I would say that yeah, it is something that we have very much in mind, and trying to be pragmatic and sensible in our approach.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anything else with a question or a comment or a piece of information you need clarity on?
Could I ask another question? Am I allowed to?
Well. And
I'll wrap two up in one, if I may. In terms of the new SRA regulations, the old 2011 Code of Conduct had indicative behaviours, either positive or negative. Are they still of any use in relation to the new regulations, the indicative behaviours? So that's my first question. And the second question relates to enforcement. You mentioned transparency rules and firms' websites. A number of firms have done all that they can to comply, and seemingly some have not done as much, if I can put it that way. Where is the SRA going next with regard to enforcement of the transparency rules?
So indicative behaviours, you're right, we've removed them from the new codes of conduct. We found that they were I was in the SRA in 2011, so I remember where they were introduced, and I think they were thought they might be helpful in showing some ways in which you may comply and some ways you might not. But I think they were generally were regarded as being a bit confusing because they weren't a rule, they weren't mandatory. So I think are they useful? I think it's probably more for you to judge as to whether you think they're helpful. You do see a lot of commentators saying that generally, if you continue to apply the 2011 standards and including the IBs to your current situation, then you probably won't go far wrong. And I think there's probably an element of truth in that. I mean, we haven't, in terms of the rewriting of the standards and regulations, changed our approach to what we think is important, the kind of things that we are worried about, the kind of behaviours of risk to clients, risk to client monies, acting in a conflict of interest, acting without integrity, misleading the court. Those things haven't really changed. What we're saying is you've perhaps got a bit more flexibility to understand how to apply these issues around client care letters, what information you give to your clients, that sort of thing, because you know your client base and better than we will. So are they still helpful? I don't know. I think if you think they're still helpful and want to refer to them, then obviously there's no harm in doing so. But obviously we have taken them out because we felt that they were probably confusing. In relation to transparency, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because we believe that there are very good policy reasons why firms should publish information on their websites to help consumers make informed choices about when they're buying legal services, particularly in key areas such as road traffic accidents, conveyancing, wills, that sort of thing. We think there's a big gulf, and we've got lots of evidence that shows that firms which publish price transparency information actually get more work, they get less complaints from clients because they understand the basis of their pricing. So we've done a lot of research around this, which shows it's a good thing. But obviously a lot of, and some law firms, it must be said, have embraced this and gone far above our transparency requirements and have seen the benefits of being upfront about your pricing structures and the services that we're doing. But we knew before we brought the rules in that only about 18% of firms actually had any price information on their website. And we know, and we're now 15 months into the price transparency requirements because they came in 2018. There's a big drive by the Competition Markets Authority to bring these in across all legal services providers. That there are still a lot of firms are trying to do their best, and it's quite complex and it's a change, and we accept that there are there's been some issues and delays in updating websites, and again we are looking at firms' websites and have been doing web sweeps to see what the level of compliance is. And for firms, we've got firms who are simply ignoring our requirements, and we don't think that's good enough. We don't think that's acceptable. And we will take action in relation to those firms. And if we're going to do this properly, we need to have a fairly level playing field. So we need everyone to have, so that clients, consumers, when they're looking in Huddersfield and they're looking at websites, that they've got the information they need to make informed decisions. So we are looking at it. It's been in place now for long enough to have bedded down. We've done a lot of what we've tried to do, helpful information about how things could be presented. We've done a lot of engagement on these issues. And we are web sweeping and checking. And then if we think a firm is trying to do the right things, we're trying to say, look, you know, you need to think about these and put these things right. But if it's a disregard, complete disregard, and a failure to engage with us, then we will take action.
Thank you. I think it's very interesting that the research shows that those that have complied are generating more work. So that's good to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, it is interesting, because I think there is a, you know, the legal profession, of which obviously I'm a member, you know, we tend to be perhaps not to be on the front foot of these issues as other potential more commercial suppliers. I'm not quite sure if that's the right word, but there is a reluctance, there is a fear about putting prices out, because firms will think, well, you know, my competitors will know what I'm charging, or I'll scare clients off. But actually the research shows that it's not true that you will get more work if you are clear, because, you know, clients, not often, they overestimate the cost of their legal services by 25%. They won't go to see lawyers because they think it's much more expensive than it is. And when lawyers say, well, actually, I can do a simple will for this, or I can do a divorce for this, they will often think, well, gosh, I will go to a firm solicitor for this piece of work, rather than an unregulated will provider or another provider, because actually they think it's quite good value. But there is a perception that lawyers are very expensive, and we think that's not true. But people, to make those judgment calls, need to have the information so they can make those assessments. So, I mean, I don't want to rehash the whole drivers why we've done that, but that's it in a nutshell. And as I said, some firms have done fantastic work on doing it. Some firms, for them, it's not a priority, and we need to do what we can to encourage firms to make sure they do comply. If they're trying, that's one part. If they're not trying at all, then clearly we can't allow that to continue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Steve, was there anything that you wanted to add at all to the end of the session? Or
sorry, I'll unmute myself. Nothing from me other than just to say thank you to Carol for informative session, and as Emma said, it will be available as a recording. I think you'll send the link around, because there's quite often a lot of information that you may miss when you're watching these things, and hopefully you'll pick it up if you watch it again. But and also share it amongst members of your staff if you need to. And finally, I think Emma did mention there, if anybody does have a question, I'm sure we can email Carol if anybody has a question, in particular if it's a question you want asked in confidence, we can sort of facilitate that.
Absolutely. And I'll ask Carol and her team, if she doesn't mind, to share any follow-up information on the training issue regarding furloughed employees, because it's something that's come up time and time again, the concerns. That would be fantastic to share that. Carol, is there anything else you wanted to...
No, I just repeat what you've just said, Emma, that we're very keen to hear from everyone, and we are in unprecedented times, and you may have issues around the impact of coronavirus. I think it was Wayne's question about the Welsh Government response that is, I wasn't aware of. And there may be particularly some interesting issues coming out of Wales that that perhaps haven't yet been flagged up with us. So yes, please, if you ask us a question, I'll either come back to you personally, and if we think it's something that we should communicate more generally, we will take steps to do that. So yes, please do feel free to be in contact.
Thank you. I just want to quickly highlight two events that we've got coming up to save the date for next Tuesday. I think it is with the SBA, the Solicitors Charity, which has released a £1 million fund to help individual solicitors that have financial hardship due to COVID. And I'm also working on an event with the Equality and Human Rights Commission in Wales to look into, they've just released an interim report, which is on our website, on the impact of video hearings and video instructions with clients within their protected groups, but particularly disabled individuals. And we're running a really interesting event on the week of the 4th of May, so I'll share information on that very soon. And there could potentially be issues that you want to question the SRA over with regards to that type of working with those groups, so with video hearings and instructions as well. So lots of crossovers in terms of some of the events we're running, which we've discussed today. So stay in touch, stay engaged with the events page. I'll follow this up. I'll send you an email with all the links, with the presentation from Carol, and also those links again that are within there, and a link again to our COVID update page, which has regular rolling information from all the main bodies as well. So thank you very, very much again. Take care, stay safe, and I look forward to seeing you all again very, very soon. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you all.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.